safe as I'd go fly.
Just have to, I have the mic. So thank you all for your very warm welcome. I'm so impressed with all the impromptu poetry. I'm quite scared of following on. But my good friends Fiona O'Toole and Colin Creedon reminded me I'd be with my own. I grew up in Cork City, and I used to sometimes go past their house to the Shandon Sweet Factory for a couple of pennyworth of bruss, which was the chips of boiled sweets, and you got it in the Coleman newspaper. I was at school at Skulleater, which was Annie McSweeney was a sister of Terence McSweeney, the Lord Mayor who died in hunger strike. And it was quite eccentric, kind of a dame school, where we met all sorts of interesting characters who kind of floated in and out of our lives there. So one of them was Seamus Murphy, the sculptor, who you might know he did one of the women from the Coal Cave, the Onion Sellers. And he has a little water trough for dogs that some restaurant commissioned, and a lot of other famous sculptures. So when he taught us, he asked us to look up as we walked around Cork at the wonderful stonework. When I went to Clonmara then, I appreciated the dry stone walls and the beautiful gate pillars that they make. So this poem is in memory of Seamus. The Mason's Stroke, Seamus Murphy, sculptor, 1910 to 1977. Impregnated with dust and a feeling for stone, relayed through the quarries by men like the gargoyle, jackdaw, or blue skull. There is no regularity in nature, they said, as the tulip wilted, while you struggled to carve it on a soft block, until they show the new apprentice how to keep pressure on the little finger. In serried order, you laid out fire-sharp chisels, hammers, and a rubstone for your first job, a marble pulpit for Fomoy. Danny Melt put a section of it on your banker and swept away the spalls. You talked headstones over beer and how the granite fusilier carved the home chapel. Your sculptor's reputation grew monumental, boy, despite yourself. Before you went to London and Paris, you learned the secret language of stone and broke open its silence. And I'm just going to go to a book here. We used to go to Tilly Fleischman was Professor Eloise Fleischman's mother, and she was a pupil of the last pupil of Liszt. And we used to, once a year, we'd go to play for her, and then she'd play for us. And I didn't realise, you know, the big European connection until we went to Salzburg Musical Festival many years later. And I was with the late Bridget Doolin and another woman who were pupils of Tilly Fleischman. And we got talking to an Austrian woman in the cafe who also had studied with the pupil of the pupil of Liszt. And they were hugging each other in great excitement. She lived off the Wellington Road in one of those big terraces there. The music lesson. A piano in a tall slated terraced house, which languishes out of its time. I greet the maestro in stiff black silken cameo. She is a standard bearer in exile. The metronome clicks. Chords and churny, Siegfried and legend, notes like drops steady from an iron eave. Until like a cloud of starlings, a melody interweaves and swoops in intricate winged touches. From Liszt to pupil, from pupil to madame, I hear the whirling breath of 100 wings and fail to fly. So. I have a little bit of my gin and tonic. I was telling Paul that I came across Ilya Kaminsky and I loved his poetry. I sent away for dancing in Odessa to Tupelo Press. And then I saw he was reading in O'Vale, but I couldn't get down to it. So I envied you the wonderful honeypot of poetry that Paul and his team organise here. I think it's fantastic. So, next poem really comes from that trip to Salzburg. Within Salzburg, soft land. There is only one way down. All arrayed in white, our group is gathered at inside the mountaintop. We straddle behind one another on the miner's wooden slide, legs outside legs, like a strange centipede. The brake is released. No way back. Fear isolates. This is a journey I face alone. We shoot down a white surface. The friction burn I feel when I trail my hand, like the memory of my son hurtling down the birth canal. The slide comes to a halt beside a lake suffused with greenish light, reflecting off stalactites and stalagmites and phallic shapes. A beam is lifted to release the small wooden door. We are ushered into bright summer light on a meadow woven with wild flowers, blue gentians, purple vetch, yellow of cowslips and bellflowers, a shock of colour after white. I look up at the mountain enclosing a salt mine where slaves once laboured. It leaves a shiver. Mm. Interestingly, if you look up, if you Google the salt mine for a holiday, they never mention there were slaves in the salt mine. And I don't know if you've heard of the Wild Atlantic Way. It's very after the visit of Donegal. So we have a new discovery point near Clifton called Derry Gimble Bog. It's where the Alcock and Brown landed on their trip across the Atlantic. And it's also where the Marconi cable station is. But I think it's much nicer than a discovery point. It's the experience of the bog is what I enjoy. There's a path right through it. You don't fall into a bog hole and get yourself all nice and muddy. Derry Gimble Bog. The road is hedged with bursts of gold, drifting faint smell of coconut. Senses are heightened before I enter a landscape of subtlety and nuance. I reach the bog, stretching out low into unhindered wind, except where stark rock emerges. Outcrops of a high grey table are gables like a stone house, sheltering a canny sheep, legs tucked under. Watching the others flow over rough terrain, sturdy white fleeces on delicate black legs, I hear the ripping Velcro sound as black matching heads busily crop. The washed out beiges and ochres of winter are slowly greening, soon brushed with muted colours of sphagnum moss, heather sedges, fragile cotton and purple moorgrass. Low hummocks and hollows are broken by patterned pools. I pass one edged with silver flashes, the surface moved as if by a biblical wind. Skylarks are rising, vibrating crescendos of feathers, piercing the air with their song of unlimited joy. I'm walking in deep time, layered over 4,000 years. If you sink a quarter, each section yields 5 centuries. You can read the stories, the history and the pollen, a preserved manuscript. When we retired, we were lucky that we, my husband and myself both wanted to live in Connemara. Doesn't always happen. So this is a love poem for him. A praise poem for John. Curled on a cushioned rock you've carved out for me. There's an incessant humming, busy until a bumblebee full stops with a buzz. Erisbeg mounts to a blue sky. Little poppadoms on your fuchsia dance in scarlet. As another bee dives into the bell of an orange nasturtium. There's a whir of blurred wings and a commentary from the occasional finch before he flies in arabesques. Sun in September creates urgency, yet the sea is lazy, hardly brimming under seaweed. It's everything you want to seal in a globe to shake in the grey winter. After we've gathered your honey, bee and I. Another one for John. He's not badly into poetry himself, but he does his best. Love comes in edgeways. My husband in the garden digs and double digs the earth. The turning of sobs, a procession of small angles. His foot presses the straight-sided blade. There is a clink of stone. Now as the field slopes to the sea, green is broken by a dark rectangle where rhubarb will probe winter's dreams. When the soil warms, it'll cradle seeds as I have cradled his. The rhubarb reddens and grows ripe. We taste it and sweets our communion. We harvest strawberries to offer each other, as once I popped grapes in his mouth on Ross Bay Strand 5 decades ago. We sip wine from mechanics, easing aches of body, pain of mind, toasting our journey in the new sphere, the layer of life that powers reflective thought. Time melds. Brendan in our writers group says to me, in every poem John is working and I'm doing nothing. So it might be the secret of a happy marriage. I live not too far from Letterfrack, of ill fame, and makes you more aware of what happened in Irish society in the past. Echoing silence after the Ryan report into child abuse 2009. This is a museum where archaeologists are still working, piecing together what went before, holding a fragment in their hands, feeling the cold of it, letting their mind into the life so they can complete the image, the fresco of one moment. A boy is in it, he is in distress. They do not find his tears. Years are spent searching, papers rustling, notes made, comparing this with that, trying to extract meaning from the hieroglyphs of a system, but they cannot capture the sounds the boy hears, sounds he cannot forget. They get weary in this museum, puzzled with the god of that time, who had different faces, presenting sun only to some, and darkness always to others. There were cult disciples of the darkness, who penned in children for sacrifice. The disciples of the sun cult looked the other way. The girls in the damaged fresco hold hands out as if in supplication. In the museum, they work on, lights beaming out late at night. They call in artists to honour their work. The book of harrowed hours. A book to record what could never all be found, what could never all be heard, what could never all be sensed, what could never all be forgiven. And just thought I'd Manon, we live right on Manon Bay, and it's reputed to be called off Manon on MacLair, the sea god. And the legends about him are very fascinating, so I've kind of formed a bit of relationship with So. This is where the... Fan was his wife, and she was... she went off with our pristine hero, Cucullin. Fand Mananon MacLir's lament for his unfaithful queen. She was the storm that rattled my bones, oh the pain, yet her body was ripeness which I spit like an apple for seeds. For me she was music, music that thundered down cliffs. For me she was the reason the sky silvered, the world closed, and there was only her and me. She didn't know that I was the reason rats ran for cover. I was the reason children shriveled, and when I walked in there was a silence louder than no sound. Yet after she left, they told me, she said, I hear him still, I hear him still. Mm. And, summer solstice. On the longest day when the sun stands still, I have a conversation with Mananon MacLir, god of the oceans and of this inlet where my house is poised. I saw his chariot coming, drawn by Ainbar, a horse who gallops over Manan Bay as if the water was firm ground at the Curragh, kicking up white waves as he goes. Time has a different meaning for Mananon. He tells me that the length of the day is in your mind. Joy mutes the ticking of a clock. Grief slows it, almost unbearably. It decants a day, leaving the sediment of sorrow. Now I'm going to get some more gin and tonic. Came to live in Clifton, but I realised how many offshore islands we had, and we're not really treasuring them. So I've written a few stories about them. Inishark, the island of the shark. An island you can walk around a few times in one day is a community bound to each other as well as to the sea. When it's abandoned, the cries of the birds, the crash of the siege guns of the ocean, the scrape of receding stones as the tide withdraws must echo grief. The remaining 24 islanders, bereft of the heaven of a harbour, survivors of gales and neglect, gathered to leave Inishark. On Thursday the 20th of October 1960, they left for emigration to the mainland, or flight abroad. It must have been like the chaos of a wartime forced march. Amid the war were hens in baskets, geese in sacks, and red geraniums sheltered like the one baby, 11 months old, wrapped tight. There was an iron bedstead, an iron bath, cows, sheep, cats, dogs, 10 donkeys, and a stack of hay. It was said that one of the 24 stayed one night more, walking the island many times, listening out for his two sons, lost in the channel between two islands, his own and Inishbofin. Before Thomas left, he set the table for three, pulled up three chairs and closed the door, leaving it on the latch. Mm-hmm. And, So what do you do? Ring a bell.
There's a trap door.
Daybreak. When I finger my worry beads over life playing hardball with my children, say, the texture gets smoothed quicker than my thoughts. Darkness seeps in like mist, finding all the vulnerable depressions. The day becomes inscrutable. Nothing is written on it yet. Clouds mock me, using chiaroscuro, switching between light and no light, before drawing blackout curtains to heighten fears. When there's a break in their scudding forms, I see the man in the moon, sleeping tonight in his hammock, relaxed, and holding most of his light for elsewhere. Comes morning, dawn takes charge, a security cordon, pushing back the crowd of dark in my thoughts. Rain has varnished the stones which now gleam in the light, creeping serenely into the day and into the crevices of my mind. Mm. Have I time for two
more? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got loads of time.
Yeah, really.
Loads of time.
This one is back to my beloved Connemara again.
Thought was John.
They go together. He's a spittleman.
The ABC of Connemara. Here also the woods are no more. Traces of trees and bogs remain. Sessile oaks with grey furrowed bark. Dense hazel scrub rhymed by the hermit. Unused is the secret of alphabet of the Druids, based on their sacred trees. Their first consonants, B, L, N, Beth, Lewis, Nian, Birth, Birch, Rowan, Ash. Seasons are no longer marked with vowels. There were dual vowels for winter solstice, the birth tree, the death tree, A and I, Fir and U. Now I search for consonants and vowels in the glacier-scarred landscape, overwritten with scattered, stunted trees, which is my palimpsest. This is November, and I could choose from the stag I saw engraved on the skyline of Crocknarawl, who stood on guard, bracketed with high-crowned antlers, a medieval repository of trust. Or the burnt sienna of Bracken's dying embers, vied with on Yaman Guira, the winter wind, glistening ruby-red like a slashed pomegranate, edged with a rock russet of other tidal seaweeds. Today there was the flight of plovers, white-ringed, landingly fluttering, resettling on a span of rock in a fuss of tutus before taking off in formation down Manon Bay, skimming the mirroring water, then wheeling in a silver flash as the low sun caught their breast feathers in its applauding rays. And before I read the last one, which John comes into again, I'd like to thank Paul so much for inviting me here, and Philip for being a wonderful MC and looking after me, and all of you for being so very welcoming. Birthdays. On the radio, the distinctive northern voice cantillates his poems and birthday celebration. I hunker in my space, absorbing the burr, the cadence, a knock on the glass door. Did he me write anything about lettuce? You, my love, in your battered boots, bold jumper, and slowing steps. I find the packets for you, Lala Rasa, Buttercrunch, and Burnet. Leaving the poet, I record their names as you take seeds between finger and thumb and drop them in the opened earth. You move to cover them in their dark blanket, knees reluctant on a square of plywood, then firm in recycled strips of wood to mark the harvest, naming them with the pen impervious to rain and salt. I mind an urgent baptism when we were lithe and quick but anguished, me blood staunched, you rock steady, as we sped the long road to hospital. Our first seed germinated still in my womb, we chose, discarded, settled on a boy's name, a girl's name. A son was born, his breath precarious, but he held fast, the psalmist's first olive shoot around the kitchen table, its surface now like a story, marked and grooved and owned. Thank you very much.